now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my guest is Professor Daryl Hamamoto, formerly of UC Berkeley System, and the author of Servitors of Empire. We've had Daryl on the show in the past. Daryl has been a voice in the wilderness in many ways because of the politically correct, charged, doxing type atmosphere out of which he emerged. He was the rebel in residence for a long period of time. But now, you know, he's out and been out, and he's going to be having his own syndicated show coming up. I'll let Daryl explain all that to you. So without any further ado, Daryl Hamamoto, welcome back to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
James, thank you so much for inviting me here today. I'm so excited to be here with you and your audience. And audience members, don't try to understand this too quickly. I'm not one of these academics who are complaining about political correctness, cultural Marxism, blah, blah, blah. I'm tired of hearing Jordan Peterson or Brent, whatever his face is, and all these people who are whining and crying and complaining and do not offer any solutions. And I think that's exactly why these people have been put out there and allowed to blather on about how we need to bring back certain traditions and on and on and on. I have an approach, James, for you and your audience and the worldwide population to just transcend all that garbage that's deliberately being put out there to hold back the evolution of humanity. And in order to go forward, James, we're going to go back, way back.
Well, definitely. Let's hear it. You've got the floor, Daryl, just wherever you want to start from.
Okay. Well, you know, I've been following your work for years now. You have talked about the Drago, the reptilian component of various animal species, including possibly mankind, Homo sapiens sapiens. And I said, well, I'm going to draw from my base of knowledge. I've been studying this for years. And by golly, you know what? After I retired from the University of California, I was now able to pursue this full time. And I'm so happy. That's why I'm so excited today. Because, James, I'm going to be previewing an entire new approach within academia that will rejuvenate it and train a whole new generation of young people for something that's eminently practical and incredibly fascinating, because it's about the human story. It's about humankind. It's about the animal world, the natural world in general. And ironically, it's because of all this emphasis on androids and human computer interfaces and the uncanny valley that we are beginning to reevaluate what are our characteristics as human beings, as a species. So that has been one of the good outcomes of the Silicon Valley takeover to develop Silicon Humanity, right? A microchip to community. I mean, that's why it's called the Silicon Valley. It's Twilight language. It's not about circuits. It's about turning us into a silicon life form, transferring us from a carbon-based life form, right? So I've had a lot of time to think about this, James, and the way we're going to, I'll just start from the beginning, all right? So people can start working on this mentally. But we're going to fund this by, and by the way, this is not a solicitation. I don't want you to get James in trouble or myself in trouble with the Securities Exchange Commission. This is not a solicitation. This is just an idea. This is a vision. And together, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to make it happen. But what I want to do is create an endowed chair at the top university in the world, and create a chair, and I hope to sit on it. It's going to be an open competition, but I hope you'll consider me as being one of the top candidates to sit in this endowed chair. And it'll be a chair dedicated to crypto studies, all things crypto, from the finance, cryptocurrency is what we're thinking about. But what I'm going to talk about today, more specifically, cryptozoology. crypto history, crypto geography, crypto bio, you know, on and on and on. All the areas that the mainstream disciplines from the sciences to the humanities neglect on purpose. So I'm going to be filling this void. And here's the interesting part. How are we going to finance that? Well, there's all these instant Bitcoin millionaires, maybe even billionaires. Correct, James? You might be one of them. I'm not going to delve into your personal finances, but I missed out on the crypto. I bought silver instead. But anyway, we're going to fund it through all these crypto millionaires. And this is going to be the first endowed academic chair entirely funded by cryptocurrency. And that in itself is going to be highly newsworthy. And I'm announcing it to you, James, and your audience today for the first time. I had a vision this morning as I was prepping. I said, well, gee, all these great plans, how, you know, it requires money. Well, hey, here we go. Here's our opportunity. So anyway, I'm throwing that out there. Crypto millionaires, keep listening. So you may say, geez, we're going to have to really start from scratch, from the bottom. This is so, it's such a revolutionary approach. No, it's not. It's been here all along. It's just been occulted, not occult, occulted, hidden away. And instead, what did they give us? They gave us queer studies, GLBTQ consciousness, ethnic studies, gender studies, women's, you know, all of that, that we're hearing that Jordan Peterson, the Canadian subject, and other individuals from overseas who have been selected to throw this flak at us and pretend that they're the opposition, they're the controlled opposition, right? So we've heard that already. And what's happened is that what I have, well, I already knew this, but I was really able to do a deep dive that there are people who have had spent entire very productive academic careers. For example, Professor Brian P. Copenhaver, you know, one of my colleagues in the University of California, he's at UCLA. Great book. It's called Magic in Western Culture, right? He was there for 30, 40 years. I think he's retired now, but... And I won't go through these. I have a whole collection of academic literature and books that talk about, anything from cryptozoology to the magic tradition, Western esoterica, as well as Asian esoteric traditions. You know, our friend and colleague, Masaaki Miyagawa, delves heavily into that. He comes from that lineage, that bloodline. And that's going to be one of the main focuses of my show, right? So it's been in place here. It's been here all along. And I'd like to spend some time at this point to introduce to you and your audience, or some of you may already be aware of these publications, but just a couple of examples of academic journals that have been around, not super long at the Royal Society, but they've been around long enough to establish their bona fides and to develop a interested, albeit specialized, audience of their own. And my function, of course, as this person who's sitting in this endowed chair, will to bring it to bring this idea, this whole vision, to the larger public and involve children, students, retirees. Everybody can get involved in this. Now, the first journal that you might be interested in, your audience, is titled The Journal of Scientific Exploration. And that sounds generic. It sounds very nondescript, let's put it that way. I think it's intentional, because let me read to you its own description, and you'll see why I'm so excited. It says, the Journal of Scientific Journal of Scientific Explanation is a quarterly peer-reviewed journal. Since 1987, the JSE has published original research on topics of interest that cover a wide spectrum, ranging from apparent anomalies in well-established disciplines to rogue phenomena that seem to belong to no established discipline, as well as philosophical issues about the connections among the disciplines. And it has book reviews, letters to the, you know, peer correspondence, and all this. And $60 a year and you get four issues. And I think you have to be a member of the JSE itself, which is fine. So you have that, and it's a wide range of articles. I can get them through my own, services, and I can even share some. I do have a Patreon account, by the way, and I sometimes share these articles if people are interested in pursuing this and just kind of taking a glimpse at it. Another excellent journal is titled International Society of Cryptozoology, founded in 1982. They all kind of started in the 80s for some reason. I think this is because already the agenda in academia was to start queering everybody and start racializing everybody and start dividing people in the 80s. So they were kind of getting ahead of this to say, we have to carve out our space here and come together as a community so that we aren't completely overwhelmed, overshadowed by this onslaught. Which, by the way, I'm happy to announce to you, James, and to your viewers that the whole scare of the last 40, particularly over the past 10 years, but it's been a long time coming. Over the last 10 years, we are going to see, for the most part, the end of GLBTQ studies at the university. Racial, gender studies, identity politics studies is finished. It's over. And ironically, it was this false flag bio attack. And by the way, that's also part of the cryptozoological investigative stream here for us. That has wiped it clean because those people are not on campus anymore. They physically have been expunged from it. And I think that's the way of the establishment kind of yanking back their chain and saying, okay, you've done your job. You brought your Milo, all your limited hangouts, your Milo Yiannopoulos, and you went to Berkeley and they threw eggs on you and they hit you with bike locks. And, we had that whole Trigglypuff and all the different characters trotted off for a couple years. So that's over. Now we're moving into the next phase. We're going in right now into the bio warfare, which, by the way, also makes this area of study so much more important. The apparent, not ethnic cleansing, but species cleansing of planet Earth makes this line of inquiry important to our survival. It's hardly trivial. It's hardly just fun and games, although it is highly fascinating and engaging. So here's another journal for you, International Society of Cryptozoology, founded in 1982. And this is how the journal itself, in its editorial policy, defines cryptozoology. It refers to unknown crypto, hidden, right? Zoology, well, we can go with the conventional designation. And that itself, zoology is a relative, it's a modern discipline. And for all the abuse that's been heaped upon people like Charles Darwin, he was one of the fathers of what we call today as zoology. And he was also an excellent recorder, a painter of natural the natural environment, flowers, animals, and he kept incredible diaries. And unfortunately, again, the race, class, gender people hammer away at Darwin. They want to pull down his statue and say, well, he's the father of evolution and it's, fake science and all that. Yeah, he was. And some evolutionary principles are have been scientifically established. So he's come under a lot. I'm not defending Charles Darwin. He was a representative of Victorian England in the Age of Exploration, which, by the way, it was during the Victorian age of colonizing the entire world where all these cryptids started being observed, right? And it was because of these Victorian scientists who went into areas where non-native people had never been. They understand these animals as being part of their habitat, of their world. But if you're coming from a little island in Northern Europe called Britain, England, Albion, and you're going to the Congo, to you it's fantastic, it's marvelous. So anyway, that's kind of the origins of both the fascination of the unusual, these different species that hadn't been seen, and also the revulsion, the repulsion of it, Right. And that's the anti-science group, the skeptics that you and I and your audience still have to deal with. And that number is dwindling. That's another piece of good news because of all this research that's being done on their terms in academia, in the university. And it fits all their criteria for what constitutes science versus mythology and folklore. Right. So the unknowns, this is how they define it. Even though they typically are known to local populations, the native population, at least sufficiently so that we often indirectly know of their existence and certain aspects of their appearance and behavior, it would be better to call them animals, right? Undescribed by science, that's the phrase they use, instead of, you know, monsters or creatures, at least according to prescribed zoological rules, to which you will return later. These animals are truly hidden in much the same way as those species of the past, which, after numerous genetic transformations, gave birth to the species of today. We know that such ancient species must have existed, but we have yet to find the fossil remains of many of them, and hence their relationship with animals, both living and extinct, are only dimly perceived. And on it goes to try to establish the rationale for this particular subspecialty that they call cryptozoology. And James, I'm monopolizing what I hoped would be a conversation, so I'm going to pause and have a sip of my Assam black tea while you give us your preliminary. Am I crazy or am I on point here?
You're on point, because while you were talking about that, I thought about the private correspondence of President Teddy Roosevelt talking about this big land ape in North America, because as many people know, Teddy Roosevelt was a big game hunter. He used to go on safaris in Africa and whatnot. And to him and to his colleagues that were big game hunters, this big ape that was roaming the North American wilds was just another animal, to use that term, to go look for. And I don't know if they intended to ever bag one or kill one, but in the correspondence of Roosevelt, former president, it was a given that this thing existed, right? And I was reading this one book, entirely unrelated subject. It was set in the 16th century in Japan, right when the Portuguese, the Dutch were vying for to establish an enclave, a trading enclave, in the sphere of influence in Japan. And it involved this Englishman named William someone or other, right? And he became a close advisor of the Japanese. And within the context of the story, and it was all based on his journals, the vessel he was on along the way to Japan stopped at this island. And coming from the shore of this island was two men rowing out in a boat. And as the boat got closer, it turned out that the two men in the boat were giants with six fingers, red hair, completely at variance with, you know, the local ethnicity of whatever brown-skinned people were there, right? And so these large red-haired Caucasian giants were quite belligerent and were threatening to Bill and his crew. And he describes how they eventually, you know, pulled up anchor and decided that the island was too inhospitable and went on their merry way and sought provisions or fresh water elsewhere. But the point of relevance is, within the historical context, there will be these references and allusions of these animals, right? And we know a classic example of this was, I think it was in the 1930s sometime, somewhere off Madagascar. They had pulled up in a fishing net a good old-fashioned coelacanth, a prehistoric marine animal that was supposed to be extinct hundreds of millions of years ago. But there it is, flourishing until it was caught in the net. So when one considers the depths of the ocean, just how many places are uninhabitable, and thank you for bringing the point out about the Victorian explorers, because much has been made in a negative sense about these Victorian explorers, you know, people like Kitchener and others like them. But they went to places that even the locals didn't go. They pushed out and got into regions which were considered inhospitable even by the locals. So credit mm-hmm. must be given to these people for making that effort in the name of exploration.
Yeah, the one-sided explanation, again, of the race and gender and the class and ethnic studies people, right? The one-sided explanation was that they were going there just to extract wealth and to enslave the people. Yeah, that was part of it. But the other part of it, thank you for reminding us, was this spirit of Victorian exploration. It was part of the science renaissance that brought us here to 2021. And we know that there are the disadvantages and liabilities involved with that, but it's up for us to, as human beings and as sentient creatures, to try to correct for these mistakes and errors. And that's really the spirit in which I want to pursue this whole realm of crypto studies, or I call it New World Order theory, because and we can talk about this later, but there's another dimension to my interest here, and that's how it intersects with a power, political power, economic power, financial power, right? And I know we were going to diverge in at some point a discussion of the hair pulling contest involved that the members of the royal household, the royal house of England, that is, or Britain, that are involved with currently, because there's always been some question about their own species being, let's say it without tipping our hand here. So I'm interested in the science. I'm interested in the politics, society, and the culture, everything. That's why I call it New World Order studies, because it's a part of that, the New World Order studies theory, which I'm pioneered it, right? I guess I'm the only proponent of it so far. The other people are still, you know, hammering on the race, class, gender themes, right? Is how all this works together to shape human experience and to either advance or retard human civilization and exploration. So that's my whole, you know, part of my, you know, larger framework here. Now, I know that, as you mentioned, that the situation in the Japans, as they call the islands, which was unknown to the explorer, at least from what we can tell of the 16th century. And of course, we know that they came with a Bible in one hand and a sword in the other.
A flintlock in the other and a sword.
Right. And they immediately sold the flintlocks to the local Japanese warlords, the daimyo, so that he can create civil war and hopefully take over the island, right? That's where the politics come in. But they had these protective guardian spirits there. They sound like Rh negatives, don't they? With the six fingers and the red hair, and they were giants, and here they were on the other side of the world. I mean, that's also part of the cryptozoology. There's all this interesting research that's going on with the Rh negative types. Perhaps you can speak to that. They were thought to be geographically centered or concentrated in certain parts of the world. And some royal lines were said to be, you know, the redheaded ones were said to be Rh negative. But you're telling me they're in East Asia.
Yeah, they were. And I'll get the title of it before from somewhere. But again, it involved this English adventurer named William, who mm-hmm. latched onto a crew, and they were going into Japan. It was the intention to carve out a sphere of influence and, you know, vying with the Dutch, vying with the Portuguese. It's just a fascinating story. But the story of the giants, particularly ones with six fingers, is literally legion around the world. I've had Jim Vieira on the show and his colleague Yu, and they talk a lot about the connection between Native American burial mounds, giant skeletons, and elsewhere around the world, megalithic structures and the local lore associated mm-hmm. with giants. And then here we have this unusual structure, to say the least, offshore of Okinawa.
Ah, Yonaguni.
Yes, it's submerged. And if you want to look at it from like an architectural standpoint, yes, that could be regarded as like a oriental version of a huge step pyramid. But what if they really are steps for some giant hominoid being? You know what I mean? I mean, this was an enormous structure. We know it's there. For whatever reason, we haven't had a lot more information come out about that place.
Well, this would be all part of this under the umbrella of crypto studies. And incidentally, I'm sure you know of the book, James, and your audience. Great book by Graham Hancock, specifically on Yonaguni. And I believe he's an expert diver, too. So he went down in there and checked it out. So there you go. I mean, examples upon examples upon examples of civilizations that grew up on other civilizations, that grew up on other civilizations, that grew on other ones. And in the Distrito Federal, Mexico City, they're still digging, you know, in the Templo Mayor area, finding, and they said, okay, this was the Mixica. Oh, no, this is the Aztecs. And they dig a little deep and they find some other civilization, and they just build and build. It's sedimented, you know, right? So this is all within science, but it's amazing how little we know about it, right? If we just took, we being in the U.S., just took 0.1% of the entire military budget and allocated to study of, you mentioned the native burial mounds. They might not have even been Native American, by the way. You know, we're just talking about how we understand it commonly, right? But that aside, what if we just took some of that money, because it is a defense related matter, if you want to think about it that way, and then brought all the children out there living in the Ohio, Mississippi Valley and all over, and have that part of their curriculum. They'll get fresh air, they'll cook for themselves and understand how their predecessors going back millennia lived. At the same time, they'll be learning archaeological excavating techniques, learning how to do DNA typing. They'll be learning, you know, wet lab type skills in the field. And in the same way that the British in the Victorian age, again, developed Egyptology as their sort of laboratory to understand the evolution of humanity, we can do that in our own home turf, wherever we are. We can be in New Zealand, Australia, in the United States, Canada, in Japan, China, and have all the local people, right, from children, and make it part of their everyday awareness that we are, you know, literally digging into our heritage and finding out who we are as a people. And you know what? The first conclusion they will come up with, these categories of race, class, gender, they're of relatively recent vintage, and they really have zero relevance when you're talking about the full scope of Homo sapiens sapiens in the Homo sapiens iterations of life, of human life forms and animal, right? So they'll be learning a multidisciplinary whole bank of knowledge there and staying healthy at the same time. So that's the pedagogical vision that I have. Why spend so much focus on the Middle East? It's great. Yes. Yeah, sure. Let's do it here in North America, in the U.S.
Well, that's a great vision for the future, because if you look at just locally, we have some anomalies here too, which the mainstream archaeologists have poo-pooed and attempted to rubbish. There's this place called the Carrion Glyphs, which I've been to a number of times. There are ancient proto-Egyptian hieroglyphs there. This is like pre-Egyptian hieroglyphs.
And wow.
As people have pointed out, if it was going to be a hoax, and who would take the time to, one has to be there at the site to see how these huge blocks were arranged, right? A, who would go to such trouble in such a remote place, risk life and limb? Presumably they brought block and tackle in there. And then not only that, but high up on the walls, carve in proto-Egyptian, and it's been pointed out, if they were going to make a hoax out of it, they would have used regular Egyptian hieroglyphics. Why is it proto, right? And yeah, it happens to be at an ancient Aboriginal site as well. So every local place has its own unique, distinct history, which intersects with the greater mystery. And I like the notion of us and children going forward, because as you know, Daryl, it's I want to see another generation to pass the torch to, right? That's
absolutely
one of my concerns. Is, and I don't want to get too deep into the stereotype of the soy boys and these malcontent millennials who, you know, self-entitled generation, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But what we need are these focused, driven, motivated, self-accountable kids who are open to the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is this cryptozoological aspect. The mainstream is having a very difficult time keeping this under wraps, because there's people out there like David Politis, even though he's not ascribing blame, if you will, to this, that, or the other cryptid for all these disappearances. The fact that so many of these people are disappearing in forests and national parks, et cetera, has been going on for a long time. So many of the place names, Diablo Mountain this, El Diablo that, right, has relevancy. He points out that whenever you come across these place names where the locals, in the days of yore, ascribe some kind of frightening or negative connotation to this place, yes, people turn up missing even in modern times. So,
absolutely.
So when one could find a happy median between the real scientific method, instead of like circling the wagons and the peer review process, which was used weaponized for so long, we have a happy medium between the real scientific method and an understanding of the lore of all these cultures around the world and the native First Nations peoples understanding of what we would call cryptids, right? Mm-hmm. And then we dig into the fossil record and you know, even more, I think we'll begin to see a greater understanding because people need to know the nature of their environment, right? And that's another thing that's sadly lacking, is people just immersed in their own headspace. They have no idea where they're at in any one time. We need to really get grounded and find out the history of this place.
Well, you know, as you're speaking, James, I just flashed on an incredible innovation in relationship between the settlers and the indigenous groups, right? Because that's a perennial problem. And again, it's an artificially created one. What if we together as human beings honored the indigenous traditions, the people in North America, or let's say the settler states and, you know, New Zealand and Australia, honored them and cooperated with them to find their lore, their mode of science to add to ours, to combine them? That would be the ultimate preservationist strategy for these groups, instead of putting them on reservations or making them into welfare wards, because they're also going to be able to be self-sufficient, and they're going to learn about their own history with undiluted, right, from our particular colonial perspective. There's so many ramifications that are pro-human species to this vision that I'm outlining here. And it's so important because, as you know, these very same groups that we are done talking about, right? Thank goodness. You're still going to hear these guys on YouTube, you know, talking, you know, through their pant leg, right? But what's going to happen is that this revolution is going to take us much, much closer to our true destiny as a species. This is what I'm convinced of. Now, we're not alone. In more ways than one, there's this journal article, Folklore, August 2006. The title is Cryptozoology in the Medieval and the Modern Worlds. This person here went back to the pre-modern, pre-scientific worldviews. And you know what? When you look at their lore and you look at their iconography, there's all kinds of beast and animals and horns, unicorns intermingling with human beings unselfconsciously. So their world is, and their vision, their cosmovision was quite different from the scientific hyper-rationalistic one right now that has brought in the GLBTQ transhumanist group to put us out so that they can fill this void, this artificial void that they have created. So we are not going to, we're going to fill that void with our knowledge, our crypto studies, New World Order studies. We're going to bring humanity, indigenous and otherwise, back into center stage. You know, I hear these, they're mostly people in women's studies. And, you know, I don't mean to cast aspersion, but they're lesbian, right? They're not going to be repopulating or reproducing. And they are just pounding. And this, their day is over. You know, like I said, I already announced at the top of the show, their day is over. But they have kept pounding for the last 20 years. The end of the anthropogenic era, the Anthropocene, they call it. You know, the Pleistocene, there's a periodization by John. This is the end of the Anthropocene, right? And they use the Leonardo da Vinci's classic rendering of the, what's the name of the man? The Vitruvian man, right? With the perfect proportions. And they stand there in their little presentations and they mock him, right? That's all part of the post-human vision that silicon life forms want to promote from Silicon Valley, right? So that's part of the agenda here. I'm going to put them out of business. They're going to be part of the fossil record very soon.
Well, we're seeing a lot of pushback, even people that we would, and I don't want to delve too much into this political schism aspect, but we're already seeing pushback because a lot of these Democrats are starting to see, you know, the bitter fruits which they helped to sow, right? I mean, almost immediately, they're talking about openly launching a cyber war against Russia. Good grief. They're, you know, within weeks of this pseudo inauguration, we already have a new airstrike in Syria and things are escalating there. What I'd like you to talk about also is, from your perspective and your studies, you know, the rich lore in Japan and in the Far East of interactions with non-human beings, what some would recall godlike. I mean, I've always been fascinated with the story. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. Amaterasu, she's the female sun deity or something, and of which the royal family, if correct me if I'm wrong, claims some descendancy from, which similar to many other cultures around the world where they you know, claim descendancy literally from the gods, if you will. But being a somewhat homogeneous enclosed society, this tradition was able to develop for a long time undiluted, if you will, compared to the rest of the world, and it's always held a lot of fascination with me.
Well, you know, that story is that fable, the creation of the Japanese archipelago seems to be, there's different iterations of it all over the world. It seems to be, you know, archetypal. But more specifically, when you're talking about what now we know as Japan, which in the old days was just a series of these indigenous tribal groupings, right? But it's, and this is another area of my focus, my study, sexuality, human sexuality. But the creation myth of the Japanese archipelago is that these islands were created by the semen of the male principle and the female, which is Amaterasu, right? And so you had these this conjunction of male and female, this coming together, copulation, that created the universe, you know, Japan, but you know, in their cosmology, it's the entire universe. But it's rooted in sexual congress between the male and the female principle coming together. What is the main focus of attack of the past 30 years of GLBT studies? It's to sever that relationship, which is en route to the post-human vision of the Silicon Valley boys, that is silicon life form or pseudo life form boys. That's the way they come together. So yeah, the mythology there, it's in modern times you have an incredible I'm from Okinawa. My maternal line is from that area that you mentioned earlier, Yonaguni, and they're distinct. Japan is not as homogeneous as you think. It's like America. There's all these different tribal groups in the way, you know, the ancient past. And one of them are Okinawan. Okinawans only became Japanese in the modern period. They were part of mainland China and Philippines and Taiwan. They were more culturally and intellectually and you know, in terms of religion, more akin to those indigenous traditions as opposed to the Japanese. And they suffered a lot of discrimination in the modern times because of their weirdness and their difference. But one of the characteristics they had is these incredible psychic powers through the maternal line, through the female principle again. And you alluded to just briefly, James, the hijacking, right, of our republic, the American Republic, formalized on that day of January 6, 2021. Well, my argument, I have a YouTube show, by the way, so people who are interested can go back 2 or 3 weeks when I talked about it in depth. But I talked about the sacred feminine, the feminine principle running through the bloodlines of Melania Knobs. That's her family name. When they were occupied by Germany, right? Countries are always being occupied, taken over, and that's what's happening to the U.S. right now. But under German rule, her family line was called Knaus. But then she was Knobs, and now she's Melania Trump. I have all since the beginning and to this day, and I'm making a prediction here for your audience. I always saw the Melania Trump and her the sacred feminine, right, the maternal line, is being more important to the destiny of the United States of America and the future of the world than that of Donald J. Trump, the president, ostensibly the president. It's really running through her. So one of my research interests is to perhaps, you know, both of her parents live in the U.S. Talk to them, get an idea of the family history, and go to Slovenia, trace those lines, look through this incredible, rich Eastern European, Central European intellectual as well as a spiritual heritage that we, especially my generation, the baby boomers, we were blacked out of that because it was behind the Iron Curtain. So there's this whole, just like, you know, crypto knowledge, we were prevented from understanding and appreciating and really, really figuring out how that Central European, Central Asian as well, traditions, spiritual, intellectual, scientific traditions, how they go into the building of the larger world civilization. I think that was kept away from us purposely as part of the Cold War. We think, oh, it's just USSR versus the free world and the US. You know, it's a nuclear standoff. Right? Yeah, that was part of it. But I think the part of the an integral part of the agenda was also to occult that tradition of Central Europe. So I think the fact that Melania Knobs and Knobs and Trump is there is a opportunity for us to as people who are part of a world civilization to reconnect with that part of the world to complete or more closely complete the picture of contemporary society and thereby avert these wars. NATO wars.
Oh, absolutely. And when you look at the lore of medieval Europe and prior to that, you see not just the parallel with the First Nations traditions around the world, native peoples, if you will, as far as mythical or cryptozoological animals and life forms. Mm-hmm. But in the old days, in old Europe, their stories were rife with werewolves and lycans and dragons. And I think that one of the problems that came about was, which is held up to this day as being a hallmark, when the Enlightenment came along, we went from the age of stupid superstition to being enlightened and scientifically orientated, what have you. But in the process, whether it was deliberate or not, Daryl, we lost all this stuff. But embedded, yes, within the lore, especially in places like the Balkans, but I'm not singling the Balkans out, mm-hmm, and you know, Hungary and Eastern Europe, and going further out to Eurasia,
yeah,
it's no coincidence. You brought up Melania. It's no coincidence that some of the most psychic and intuitive people I've ever met were from what used to be Yugoslavia. They're Croatians or whatever the case, mm-hmm, may be. And the communists, because on the surface they're this reductionist, God rejecting
materialist,
but at the core they're a bunch of Luciferian Bolsheviks. But what was happening in the West, where these very gifted people, distinct genetic profiles, some of them Rh negative and known to have in some cases ET contacts, were being mind controlled, exploited and utilized by Western intelligence. It turns out, with my discussions from people that came from the former East Bloc, that the communist intelligence services, the KGB and its satellite intel agencies in the various Warsaw Pact nations, were doing the same thing, right? So outwardly they're materialistic and they reject anything to do with spirituality, but at their inner core they're highly they're deeply interested in the psychic aspects, and also you look at a place like Bosnia, where the Bosnia pyramid is. One of my friends, she grew up in a village not too far from there, and it maybe is just Australia, maybe is just, you know, that place in Croatia, something about the water or something, but the people that I know that are Croatian, that are from that part of the world, they small sample size to be sure, Daryl, but they've had ET experiences, they've had military abduction experiences, they're extremely gifted and extremely psychic. So it is something that needs to be delved into, and there's a tremendous resource there that can be tapped for the benefit of humanity. All this occulted stuff, it's got to go out the window. There's got to be this blossoming, this springtime, if you will, where this comes out.
Well, you know, the perspective of, let's say, the Bolsheviks, the philosophical materialism, the atheism, that was for the peasantry, the working class people. The people who are in charge maintain connection and studies like Psi, right? You know, remote viewing. They kept that for themselves. And it's the same way here in the U.S. While we were going through our revolution, and currently now, we're giving a lopsided area, a realm of experience, academically or otherwise, and Science Magazine and Popular Science and all the other journals keep promoting this lopsided vision of reality for the larger population, who they want to be drones, the technocrats. A lot of them are Asian immigrants, by the way. That was my area. And they use them because they have no historical understanding, archaeological, of what the United States is, what the culture is going back. Just the textbook version they got, right? And they did very well. They scored high on the standardized test, which got them into medical school, right? But it's lopsided. And that's just the way they want it. But the people, the ruling class in the U.S., never had abandoned the trivium, all the classical, the medieval, esoteric. They always had it. Because I had a conversation with Peter Duke, an incredible filmmaker in Los Angeles. Says, well, what if we brought back the trivium and classical education? And I said, Peter, it never disappeared. There's nothing to bring back. They always had it, but they kept it for themselves. So in my particular vision of crypto studies, we're just going to build on, you know, people like Professor Covenhaver and people in Europe, Walter Honegraaff, they've already laid the foundations there. It's just that the larger population has been kept apart from it. And when you have a gift such as Melania Trump, Melania Knopf, come to public awareness and public consciousness, that is something that people can fix on and say, yeah, what's her background? Let's talk about it. And there's a reason why these British agents, such as Anna Wintour, her father was intelligence. Her father was known as Chili Bill. He had no emotions. He was like a reptile, just like she is. You probably saw her in the movies, The Devil Wears Prada, right? With Meryl Streep, great role. And then Tina Brown. These are the people that control American popular culture. They're British agents, right? And so they get us into celebrity, and they cut us off from the history, while the real people who are in charge, who are maybe headquartered in the city of London or Wall Street, practice these esoteric traditions, and they respect them. And that's their source of their power. Yes.
That's where their temporal power comes from, is an understanding of these arcane arts. which,
Absolutely.
through their controlled scientific religion, dismisses as quackery and so much superstitious mumbo jumbo. But at the deepest arcane levels, they're deeply immersed in all this stuff and MI6 and what have you.
They operate that, I'm sure. All the presidents up until President Donald J. Trump were read into that program. They were initiates, right? You and I know, and your audience knows that the people who were put in there follow a very similar pattern. The name Skull and Bones keeps coming up. By the way, I'm tired of hearing about the Freemasons and Skull and Bones and blah 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 in the Vatican. We've heard that. We've seen that YouTube show many, many times. We've absorbed it. It's true. The Bloodlines Illuminati, brilliant book, right? But can we move the ball forward now and come up with solutions? We're on the verge of extinction. You mentioned that the usurper president, the I hesitate to even enunciate or vocalize his name. He might manifest himself right during this conversation. But he's being used to as a pretext to irradiate a lot of part of the world to eradicate it. So we're in some pretty desperate times here, and we need to move on this quick. So all you crypto billionaires, pony up and fund this project. The first project ever, completely 100% financed by blockchain technology. We're going to use their technology against themselves. That's the vision.
Yes, and this is a way to get around the international travel restrictions, because if branches, if you will, or however one wants to describe them, can be set up in various locales, these branches could really, literally and figuratively, dig deep into the local areas, dig into the local traditions, do their own research, and then combine that into a centralized database, which all have access to. There won't be this whole initiate thing where you have to have the secret handshake to get to the next level of understanding, and everything is all occulted and stratified again, right? It'll be one size fits all. Everyone shares from the same pool of knowledge, which is how it used to be in some of these advanced ancient civilizations.
Absolutely. They were largely agriculturally based, so cooperation was assumed. If you didn't cooperate, you're not going to make it into the next season, right? And those who weren't didn't go along with the program, they were treated pretty harshly. They might have been taken on a hunting trip and they didn't come back with the rest of the party, but that was their form of justice, and they didn't need an elaborate court system. They had three people say, well, you did this, and then they dealt with it on that level. Instead, we have a so-called justice system up all the way up to the Supreme Court, which is largely ceremonial. It doesn't even fulfill that the bare the barest essence of what justice is amongst human beings. We know innately, and of course we're schooled and indoctrinated to morality and ethics, but we know innately when something's wrong and when something's not right. We're not even getting a modicum of that in the modern judicial system. And that, again, that's was intended. It was engineered that way. And we're frustrated and we're appealing to them. Like, that's another point I want to make here. Oh, please, Mr. Supreme Court, or even please, Mr. President, please, Mr. Legislator, please, Mr. FCC, Federal Communications Commission regulator, please don't start, bombard us with 5G, or Mr. So-and-so, stop doing this and jabbing us. We're pleading to these people as if they are in charge and have power. Whereas by natural law, we are the ones that are in charge. They need to be consulting with us, but we don't even need to recognize them, right? So this whole framework here is, you talk about equality and equalitarian values. It's the ultimate in it. It's revisiting what we are as human beings, endowed with certain abilities and inclinations, not all of them good, right? Well, I'm not presenting a utopian vision of society. We've got to work it out. But the current one, the one in place here, is about exterminationism. as a species. No exaggeration. I think everybody feels that. And you mentioned before, even the, and that's why I didn't mock them. You know, they called all their libtards and their Democrat, but they're liberals. They're so, like, come on. What, stop with the labels. You're not taking us anywhere. You're frustrating yourself to no good end. You're just chasing your own, however you want to put it. It's meaningless, and that's exactly the way the meme meisters want it. Right? We're gonna go deeper than that. We're gonna stop watching. Well, keep watching YouTube because some people are new to this, and you need to be brought up to speed, and you need to watch the canonical work, right? But I want to move into the 21st century myself, and I plan on taking a large segment of the population with me. Not that I want to be the leader of it, but I'm just saying, hey, here's a path, here's an opening, here's an opportunity. We're being presented this idea that resistance is futile. It's bad. We're at the terminus point. We're at the end point. Only divine intervention is going to save us. Well, has it ever occurred to people that the divine is so divine that it really doesn't care? They've got a lot of other business to take care of in the cosmos. So it's really up to us. And the beauty of it is that it's within our grasp.
And the divinity is within us as well. And I
Absolutely.
like the point you brought out about Melania, right? Because we have Melania, an eminently feminine figure, and then we have the predecessor, let's say, Michelle slash Michael, whatever you want to call that particular entity.
She's
And what
definitely a hybrid.
so then you have these other like chimeras, the AOCs of the world and whatever, and they represent, I wouldn't even call them a distorted version of femininity. They're just some weird Luciferian archontic abomination. And well, you brought up the conjoining between the feminine masculine principles within the Japanese context, and it made me think of the ancient Egyptian cosmology of Nut and Geb, and Nut is the sky goddess, and her belly full womb full of all the stars of the heavens, and merging with Geb, the earth god, right? So that's what it's all about, is continuation. And so many people are, for decades now, they've been holding off having children because of finances. And now there's so many young males that have no interest in raising families. And it's even worse than that, that there are many females that have no inclination to be mothers. So we turn this around. We make family, core values at the center of it, where it should have been to begin with. And then have everyone have this vast base of knowledge that you're talking about, where there's no more mysteries. Everything needs is mystified these days, and described in gobbledygook. So you have that stratification again between the exalted ones and the dumbed down masses. But anyhow, we're just getting started. There's been a fascinating first segment with you, Daryl. Could you let our listeners and viewers know how they can find your work and perchance contribute to the effort you're talking about?
Certainly, I started on Christmas Eve because I know that we are into this new era, and I wanted to finally put out my original material here. And I have a live cast twice a week, Tuesday, Thursdays, 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and it's an hour-long show, and it's like mostly a 1 hour one-way conversation about any number of topics. You talked about the Egyptian dynasties. I did. My most recent talk was about mother-son incest and how that is the downfall of all civilizations, and how contemporary royalty are very much involved with the mother-son incest and serial killers here in the U.S. People like Edmund Kemper III, the Santa Cruz killer, is a product of that. So, I explore the political implications of seemingly unrelated issues. So that gives you a little flavor of my show twice a week on YouTube. And I'm going to be there until I get enough viewers to deplatform YouTube And then I'll move over into the endowed chair that's going to be funded by the Bitcoin millionaires. So that's where I'm at now. I'm also on a Thursday show. It's called the Thursday Trio. John O'Loughlin, it's called McDuff Lives, with the great investigative reporter George Webb. The three of us talk about the takeover of America through NATO and through the Pentagon and through these false flag attacks and these agents, these provocateurs, and under the guise of Proud Boys or Antifa that helped, and with the use of Ukrainian mercenaries with the orange hat who came and took. So we talk about that on Thursday, and then on Wednesday I have a call-in show with George Webb himself on another network. So Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursdays are prime time for me. And I have a once a month, I call it office hours with Professor Hamamoto for the Patreon subscribers. If you want to join the Patreon or Patreon, it's there for you. And but the larger goal is to have a syndicated call-in radio show for a worldwide English speaking audience. And there's a lot of English speakers in the in East Asia, South Asia, definitely India, Pakistan, and in the Pacific, Asia Pacific area, New Zealand, Australia, as well as the US. But it's going to have that Pacific outlook flavor as a continuation of this larger civilizational growth from Africa, the Mediterranean, Central, Eastern Europe, through Western Europe, Northern Europe, and onto the Americas. So that's the vision.
And for our dear listeners out there and you viewers, if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.